My name's Sandy, and I'm still an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Picking up where we left off, confronting the dilemma of that sixth step, which will be with us for the rest of our lives as we try to get even a more open mind about becoming willing. We take a look at our humility step in the seventh step. That's our shortest little step. Humbly asked him to remove the shortcomings. And the concept of that is fairly simple. We're just going to ask God, you know, I got all these shortcomings. I inventoried them in the fourth step, and I shared in the fifth step, and I became entirely ready in the sixth step. So now I'm up here with some fairly straightforward, going to ask God to remove these shortcomings. Now, asking God to remove the shortcomings, I think all of us could do without any help from the program. It's sort of a straightforward sentence. So the question that we have when we get to this step is, what's the difference between just regular asking God to remove these shortcomings and humbly asking God to remove these shortcomings? So we're going to pass out some papers, and you just write down your answer. The difference between just regular asking and humbly asking is, and we're going to find out, that humility, as Bill writes in the 12 and 12, has had a hard time of it in our society. It is not generally recognized as an asset. You do not see beer ads, drink Bud, get humble, you know what I mean? Or got this $42,000 car, and whenever you drive by, people go, now there's a humble driver, look at that guy. I sure wish I had a car like that. Everybody would call me humble. It's humility has not, and so we're all starting from the same spot with relative ignorance about how to answer the question, what's the difference between regular asking and humbly asking? And I remember when being confronted with this, I said, well, let's think, you know, humility, and I had no idea. I mean, it's absolutely clueless, but I did remember a movie, I think Bing Crosby was in it, Going My Way or Our Way, something. And there was a nun in that movie who I somehow had officially categorized in the back of my head as humble. Whenever she was on screen, she just looked humble. And I tried to remember what she looked like. And once again, humbly ask her, go up to the bedroom where I can get the mirror, you know, and I tried to get that humble look, you know, sort of. And that was about my best shot. I don't know what you all did, but I was just going, how do you get humble? You know, what? It's like some new dance step. I mean, just how, what is it? And so we all started from the same point of general ignorance about humility or humbly doing anything. And the dictionary suggests that it is an absence of pride, a total absence of pride. This sounded bad right there. I struggled for years over that. I know, like I said, I came out of the Marine Corps, and you know, pride and this and that, and it just seemed like it's an overstatement, you know. So there was, and I can remember some of the old groups up in Washington. They had a list of like 50 character defects, and one of them was false pride, not pride, false pride. And it was almost like pride was so powerful, it got itself put on that list under false pride, which is your pride. You know what I mean? My pride's pretty good. And the stuff that I'm proud of is good. And here's this thing. So I don't know about you. This was a terrible struggle to go, no pride? What about, I'm proud of my country. I'm proud of this. I'm proud of that. I'm proud of, you know, what are they? What is this? And it took a long time to internalize and really examine my motives whenever I used the word pride. And I'll tell you where I came out, and I really, it took a while to get, you know, to really see it. Whenever I used the word pride, I was trying to inflate myself. I'm so proud of my son who just hit the home run. hi, everyone, would you look over at the Father instead of the Son? He wouldn't have hit the home run if he wasn't my son. That's why I'm so proud of him. He makes me look good. You know, I didn't know I was saying that. But I wanted to share the attention. That's what pride had in it. And I know it just felt so foreign to have that word not be appropriate in the spiritual sense. And I finally said, pride would be how you'd stay sober without God. You know what I mean? I would appeal to your pride. I'd say, you can stay sober on your own. You can do it. Use your pride. Get in there. And so that's why it says it's not by accident in the seven deadly sins that pride heads the list. It even has its own PR man trying to convince you and I that there's some good pride. Now, I'm not going to say that there isn't good pride, patriotic and all that, but I'm talking about in a spiritual sense, that it has no place in our lives in a spiritual sense. And the reason I say that is that there's a word that is better used to really describe what we're trying to say when we say the word pride, and it's grateful. I'm so grateful my son has talents to hit a home run. And when we're doing this, we're giving God the credit for these things. We are saying, I'm so grateful to be living in the United States. I am really, in other words, it's not to build me up, it's to express a sense of my good fortune at having these things. It wasn't that I am important. And so there was one in the dictionary definition of humility, an absence of pride. And the second one was an awareness of our shortcomings, a total awareness of our shortcomings. So humility is not an easy thing to acquire, and most of us acquire it through the process of humiliation. And I can do it myself. I can, you know, how many times have I said, I'll do it my way? Oh, I love that song. Why did that come out after I got sober? That would have been my, that's the alcoholic theme song. I did it my way. Okay, I'm in jail, I'm all screwed up, but I did it my way. I didn't ask for help. I didn't let anybody get in there. This is me, man. I did it my way. And I just sort of connected with that. Isn't that wonderful? I did all that. Well, that's fine unless we're trying to get in touch with a higher power. If I'm going to do it my way, then we don't need God to be involved in my life at all. So I have to fail. I have to have these situations where I crash and burn before it gets my attention. I thought I could stay sober on willpower. I thought I could do a lot of things myself. And the reason my ego wants to do things on my own and not involve God is then I get the credit. See, my ego doesn't like God. My ego doesn't like, because he gets all the credit. Here I am going, thank you, God. I'm so glad for God for my sobriety. Well, hell with God. What about me? I'm doing, you know, my ego wants to hear about me. That's the way egos are. You know, they just want to be important. And here we are with this process of crushing the ego in order to get spiritual. So humility is a process of acquiring a new perspective. And as our seventh step in the 12 and 12 suggests, it involves pain. And this is not a very happy thing to talk about to us alcohol. Pain, pain. We're used to going, pain, take this. You're not supposed to have pain. But pain is the way that to be communicated to. It's the way, it is the guidance system, and we'll talk about in the 10th step, this is how we get communicated to when we start getting disturbed. We start experiencing, and that means we're off course. And that means that we should examine that and see what is wrong. And so here in the 7th step, it's saying we're going to have to go through a process of humility that might be painful. What is the pain? Humbly asked him to remove these shortcomings. These shortcomings are all the blockages that prevent me from turning my life over to the care of a higher power. Now, I don't know about you, but I've done a serious survey of all the problems that there are in the world that a person can have, and I've been able to reduce them to one. Not getting my way. That's the one problem that covers everything. You know what I'm saying? Whatever it may be, it comes down to not getting my way, and it's very painful for me to not get my way. And so I come into AA, you know, and I go, well, what do we do about this? Everything not going my way. You know what I mean? Because the only way I could see out of this was to get everybody to do my way. You know what I mean? I was like in the Big Book, the actor on the stage. He's well-intentioned. If just everybody would do the way I see the world ought to be, everybody would be happy. But nobody wants to pay attention to me. And they can see through my motives that I'm being selfish even when I'm trying to be kind. I remember I didn't know how to be kind. I knew how to act kindly because I saw a kind person being kind to somebody. And I said, oh, that's what kindness is. You go over and you say these words, but they weren't coming from my heart because I'm self-centered. You never can be kind when you're self-centered. You can just act like a kind person so that you can get your way. And people will go, hey, what a nice guy. Well, let's help him out. You know, good. There was always something in return for it. And so getting this new perspective, which is what goes on in this process of acquiring humility, like I say, a lot of times it's done through one humiliation after another, as it crushes our ego to show you're just not going to be able to survive on pride. You are going to have to surrender to a much deeper level than you have. I think about, you know, Chuck C's tapes and book on the new pair of glasses, and that's his description of sobriety, that what we really get is a new way of seeing the same world. The world stays the way it is, but we are given glass and suddenly we look at it and we just go, wow, this is a great place, you know, because it looks different. So the change is taking place inside of me. But, you know, if you imagine a pair of binoculars been sitting in the ocean out front here and they find them about a year later and they're locked into the close-up position, you know, which is self-centeredness. You know, all you can see is stuff here, but you want to see the big view, you know, the big picture. So you have to turn those binoculars to bring them out, but they're all rusted and it's going to be painful. It's just going, you can feel the metal almost ripping. And it's like, Jesus, this thing is probably going to break before I get them. But if we can just get them out to that, then we're going to see a whole new world. And that's what it feels like to become unself-centered. It's just like, yow! Because becoming unself-centered means not only not getting your way, but not having a way. You know, and then if you don't have a way, and this may sound like double talk, if you don't have a way, nothing cannot go your way. Everything is acceptable. You know what I mean? It rained all afternoon, you go, fine. The only reason it could be fine is that you hadn't insisted that the sun be out so you could play golf. You just go, oh yeah, okay, well, rain will do something else. We're going, you know, I'm going to do this. So here we are in the middle of this process. We're saying, would you like to go through the process of becoming unself-centered? Would you like the freedom of being unself-centered and moved into this perspective of God-centered? Would you really? Well, then let's see if you really would. And the story I like to do about this decision, this is the difference between regular asking and humbly asking. There was an old story about a farrier. A farrier is a horseshoer. And he had a blacksmith shop. And in the blacksmith shop, up on the shelf, was a whole bunch of bars of iron that had been there for years that nobody knew were there. They were to be turned into horseshoes. And the bars of iron were up there complaining about life. They'd been up there for 15 years, and they would talk in underneath the paper. Is this all there is to life? You just hang around in this dusty, hot place, listen to all that banging out there. I'll tell you, I'm so sick and tired of sitting up here. It sounded like a bar, you know what I mean, where you're sitting there. I'll tell you what's wrong with the word, wow, wow, you know, the whiners anonymous, just going on and on and on. And one day they were inventorying the place, and boom, they rip open the thing and say, geez, you guys have been up here for 20, you're not supposed to be. I knew we weren't supposed to be on this shelf. What's the deal? You're supposed to be a horseshoe. You are going to be transformed into something incredibly useful. You're going to be on this magnificent animal. You're going to be seeing sights you never dreamed existed, over hills, valleys. It's the most wonderful feel. Oh, man, I'm out of here, I'm out of here, I'm out of here. I am asking to be removed from the shelf. Well, there's a small process you have to go through first, and we're going to show you that now, and that this will turn you into a horseshoe. And they grab one down, put them on in the fire till it gets red hot, and put them on the anvil, ba-bang, ba-bang, in the hot water, in the water, you know, the steam's coming up, bang, 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 and they're all watching this thing down there. And they punch a couple holes in it for the nails, and they go, there, this is what you are entitled to become. And they're going, well, it's not that bad up here on this ship. Now I look around. I don't want to rush into something. I don't even know what a horse is. I'm not. You know, we just were complaining. Ha ha, it was kind of a joke. It's really not that bad. We're out of the rain. It's not that bad. So for the horseshoes, the difference between asking and humbly asking was, after you saw that, then you could humbly ask. Understanding totally what's involved and still wanting to go ahead is humility. It is an awareness of our shortcoming, of the allness of God and the nothingness of self. Would you really like to go through that process? And again, we go, well, I'd like to go partway through. I'd like to try a little bit and see how it is and compare it. I would like, and none of those choices are available. It is, would you like to learn how to reduce all the demands that exist in your life instead of insisting that you meet them? That's what freedom is to have demand reduction. I never thought about the equation from that side. I was always trying to meet the needs of greed. Two cars, another house, a bigger boat. And then I will answer this demand inside for all that stuff. How would you like to have the demand reduced so you don't need any stuff? Well, sounds good in theory. But I'm not sure I really want that. And it takes a long time to realize that is happiness, is being absolutely content with exactly what you have today. Just going, you know, I really got it made today. Yeah, Hank was talking to me before the meeting that's what it is. It's never been better. Never been better. The only way it can get there is to have the demands that it be better removed. And that's another word that is powerful in the spiritual program, and it's throughout all our literature. Before we come into and get involved in this spiritual path, we talk about solutions to problems, and we figure them out. You know what I mean? That's how you see problem. Problem solving involves going through and finding a solution to the problems. You come in here, you know what happens to problems spiritually? They are removed. They don't get figured out. Your alcoholism, your desire for drinking and all that, it was lifted out of you. I used to worry how I became an alcoholic, what it's all this about. You know, I don't even care now. Why would I care about what alcoholism is or why I'm an alcoholic or I ever became one? You know why? Because it doesn't bother me. It was lifted out somewhere. I just totally lost interest in it. It's like when I was 6 years old, somebody stole my crayon box, and you know something? I haven't thought about that in a long time. It's just been lifted away. It's not a relevant situation in my life. So if this alcohol problem was lifted away, this is what the spiritual solution looks like. I'm having a problem with greed. All I think about is this. What can I do? You surrender. We just totally surrender and recognize we're powerless over solving that. We're going to turn this over, and we're going to go through the pain of having it removed. Now, let's talk about the pain 1 second, because I don't want to portray it as something excruciating and all that. The pain in spirituality reminds me of the pain involved in getting in shape and staying in shape. If you haven't worked out in a long time and you go over to the gym, man, those first 3 weeks, those muscles are killing you. Remember that? And you can't even sleep at night. Jeez, things are hurting you didn't know you owned. I mean, you know, it is. But once you get in shape and you're over there doing the same workout that you were doing 3 weeks earlier, it becomes effort. It's just, I'm expending some effort in maintaining this conditioning. And we actually come to enjoy it because we're very familiar with the results that come about as a result of this effort. And the same thing happens as we change our attitude about spiritual change and the pain, and pain becomes effort. And Bill writes about that in the 12 and 12. Our whole attitude towards not getting my way, and going through the effort of not getting my way changes because I know what's on the other side. It's beautiful. It's freedom. So that's why pain becomes effort or something like that. It's no longer that, oh God, do I have to go through that? It's like, oh yes, I see that you go through that, and that's fine with me because I know what's over there, baby. Boom! And it doesn't even seem like pain, but it's the same amount of cosmic change or whatever we want to call it inside of us. So to me, that's what step 7's about, and that's the last one that has a fairly long presentation. Step 8 and 9 have to do with the past, and step 10 has to do with living a day at a time. And it's impossible to live a day at a time and drag the 80s with us. And we have all the memories. We've got 50 people that we don't want to run into. We got this thing. We got that embarrassing situation we hope never comes up. But we're going to live one day at a time and be happy, joyous, and free. You just can't do it. So we have 2 steps that are designed to help us deal with the past to the best of our ability in order that we are free to live a day at a time. And it suggests we make a list of all the people we had harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. And what is suggested in here is that we learn out of this list and the harm we've done to others, and this harm is much more expansive than punching somebody in the nose or refusing to pay $2,000 back to them. There's much subtler forms of harm, whether we are cheerless at work, we had a bad weekend, and we want to make sure no one else is happy. You know what I mean? When people come in to tell us joyfully about their weekend, we go, oh yeah, big deal. Well, I sat around the house all weekend, you know, and just take them down a few notches so they don't stand up there happy, joyous, and free. You know what I mean? Let's spread a little gloom around and level the playing field out. Or maybe we withhold affection that people who ought to get it. Maybe we gossip about people all the time to bring them down and make us feel better. Maybe we just go around disrupting things because we're so good at keeping people off balance. Alcoholics have a wonderful talent for bringing out the very worst in everyone. It's just amazing. An alcoholic was traveling through a little Midwestern town, about 800 people in it. The town was the most peaceful place. He spent 2 nights there getting drunk in the local gin mill, drove on. The town's never been the same. They're just at each other's throat, you know what I mean? So we have this, and we like to keep people off balance because then they won't focus on our drinking. You know what I mean? So we develop this best defense is a good offense and keep them out of our business. And so we have these various ways of, as the steps suggest, not living in harmony with the world around us. And so the 8th step is really all about harmony, how we can learn to live in harmony with the world around us. And there was a song in World War II, it was called Poor Johnny One Note. I don't know if anybody might remember that. Poor, and he was a clarinet player. He only could play one note, and he's trying to get a job in a band, and nobody will hire him because he only can play the one note, you know, beep. And it was sort of a humorous song about, you know, you just ain't going to make it, man, if you only know one note. And I always felt I related to this guy. I only knew one note. And you know, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, guess which one I knew? Me. And I only played that note everywhere I went. I just came into the room and I went, me. And I thought communication was telling you more about me, so that pretty soon you'd know everything about me and you would know how to behave to be in harmony with me. So my job to create harmony was to educate you how to adapt to be in harmony with me. You know, that talk show host had the guest, and he's talking, and finally he stops, and he says, well, enough about me. I've been talking all night. What do you think about me? You know, and there's just this, that's the only note we know. Self-centered people, we just, it's just me. And we come in here, and it says, no, there's harmony out there. We're going to have to learn how to live in harmony with other people. And as we live in harmony with other people, instead of bringing disharmony, we start bringing out the best in people. We start bringing out transitions. How many times have you heard people say, you know, I came to AA, my whole damn family straightened out. Whole damn family straightened out. I thought I was doing great in the program. My parents were having their 50th wedding anniversary many, many years ago. And my sister, who's in AA, she had about 8 years at the time, was organizing the reunion. All these different people are coming, and one uncle was coming. And I remember going, ah, damn, Sue, do you have to put him on the list? he gets so obnoxious. I mean, he just, you know, rant and rave, and he has that edge to him and that sort of that anger thing, and he's just, God, he's so hostile. And she said, he only does that when you're around. What? Oh, yeah, everybody loves him. He is just a great... What? If he hadn't been in AA, I never would have believed that. I would have just... What? So I said, okay, let's see if she's telling the truth. You know what I mean? So I just came in there like he was my buddy. I just ran, hey, I'm so glad to see you, John. How you doing? Da, da, da. Boy, he said, I'm so glad to see you, too. And it was like... He responded to me just the way I responded to him. So I brought out the best in him. And without knowing it, I always had brought the worst out in him. So imagine if you, each one of you, without knowing it, went around always bringing the worst out in people. You would live in a rotten world. Everywhere you went, people were being awful. And now we come in here, we're going to learn how to live in harmony. We're going to pay attention to the harm that we have done. What is the harm that we do? What is it about me? And I can change that. And as I go out, I suddenly find the world is changing. People are much nicer than they used to be. They're simply responding to a person who is no longer self-centered, but who really listens, who is God-centered, who's trying to fit in no matter where he or she goes. And to me, that's the real lesson out of the eighth step. Is to learn, what is it about me that's hitting these wrong notes that are causing all that? Don't inventory all the wrong notes out there, because we can't change that. What can I change about me so that I can be in harmony in all these different situations? And our whole world transforms itself. In the ninth step, we go out and make direct amends to these people, and this step is fairly straightforward. It suggests that we don't do it if it's going to cause harm to them. It teaches us the principle that we cannot put our well-being ahead of that of others, that we can't buy peace of mind at someone else's expense. So this is an opportunity to go, and as you heard in the history, Dr. Bob went out and did his entire ninth step with about 6 hours of sobriety. And if there's any step that is, and I remember hearing this when I first came in, don't rush into this one. You know, I heard people did the ninth step too soon and they got drunk. And there was all this stuff. Well, there is a little sentence in the 12 and 12, we might want to wait a little bit before doing this step. And I think that's been exaggerated, because it goes on to say, we want to make sure that we're solid in the program, that we're really going to be staying here. We might want to wait several weeks or longer, which is considerably less than the 6 years that I waited. But there is a lot of talk about don't rush in and we're going to do this and that. And so your sponsors are the ones to talk to about this. But it really, until we do this, we don't get the promises. The promises are all coming true as a result of putting it on the line and going in and saying, Mr. Jones, I used to work for you and I was a terrible employee and I'm in AA now. And I've done some inventory and thinking about it. And I said, I owe you a big apology. I just came over here to tell you that I wish I had done a better job for you. Thank you for seeing me. I really appreciate your time. And when we go to make these amends, this is a very classy thing. We don't go in there crawling. We are up there doing something very important in making the town we live in a better place and bringing harmony into other areas. And I always suggest to people that you think about not going in there alone. That before you go in, you stop in the men's room, the ladies' room, you get a little serenity prayer out, you read your serenity prayer, and you say to your higher power, why don't you come with me on this one? And we walk in with our heads high, and we go in, the secretary's sitting out there, and we say, would you tell Mr. Jones that we're here to see him, you know, me and my higher power, and I'm just going to go in there, and I'm going to just say, right from my heart, I wish I had worked harder. And I'm an alcoholic, I'm in AA, and I'm working my program, and thank you for your time. And it matters not if he pats us on the back and says, oh, that was the most admirable thing I ever saw, or if he said, I still think you're a jerk, get out of here. It does not matter. We are complete. We have finished our side, and we can move on from that. That's the end of the whole deal. And we pick up on those promises. You know, we'll know freedom and new happiness and not regret the past and all those wonderful things that come about by taking action with other people in the ninth step. In the 10th step, we're talking about our day-at-a-time program, and this is one of my favorite steps to talk about. Continue to take personal inventory when we're wrong, promptly admitted it. This step, in my judgment, has
the plan for how to live a day at a time. Now, what it says in the big book is, and this is important to remember, what we have, we don't have a cure for alcoholism, we have a daily reprieve contingent on our spiritual condition. So if you think about alcoholism as a fire, and our problem was that we were walking in the fire, and we're going to work the steps, and we're going to get 20 feet above it. Now we walk along, and that heat doesn't affect us at all. But any time we let down on our spiritual program, we drop down. So we're never free from the potential to be right back in that fire. On the other hand, we have an absolute guarantee that if each day we follow the principles of this program, we will never feel the heat. We will never, ever have to deal with alcohol in our lives. I haven't thought about alcohol in 2 years. I've thought about suicide, but I have not thought about alcohol. It's just not an option any more than drinking cyanide or any other things. It's just not there. And that is a gift. That is the gift of the maintenance of a day at a time program. So when we think about, well, what are we talking about? What is the point of life? What does the 10th step suggest to us? You know, what is the secret of life? You know, all these things and great philosophies that we've talked about in bars forever and all that. And we find a very simple answer in that it has nothing to do with seeing cosmic this or that or having a palace of gold or anything like that. There's an axiom in the 10th step, and I'm sure some of your old timers know the one I'm talking about. It says, there is an axiom, and it says, if something disturbs us, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with us. Well, what's wrong with us? We're disturbed. That's it. That's what's wrong with us. We're disturbed. This happened, and I got disturbed by it. Some days that happens, and I don't get disturbed by it. But today it happened, and I am disturbed. The 10th step is, how would you like to go through a day undisturbed? It's about the best we can offer you. This is the jackpot. This is the home run. That's hitting a home run in AA. Going through a whole day undisturbed. Never, 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 never being disturbed during that day. This doesn't sound like a very lofty goal, does it? You don't get a yacht. You don't get a house. You don't get a new job. You just are undisturbed. You know what that means? Peace of mind, serenity, total acceptance and at peace with everything just the way it is. That's the spiritual solution. The material solution is, I got to get all the things that I think will make me happy. Here's this, how would you like the power to just automatically be happy? I guess that would be all right. I'm not sure. It sounds like a cop-out, but I'm willing to reconsider. You know what I mean? It just, because it's so different from what we were thinking about before. So as it suggests in the book, it says there's four components to not getting disturbed. One of them with the top priority is self-restraint. Self-restraint, something we have to pray for. I like to think about it. I would like to pray to God to have an 8-second cushion between me and everything that happens. Just an 8-second cushion so that when I go out, the jerk cuts me off in traffic, my temperature goes up to 120, but I don't do anything because I have 8 seconds. And at the end of 8 seconds, it's back down here, and I go, okay, so the guy cut me out. See, my problem is, he cuts me, I go up to here, and I go, give him the bird, step on a gas, tailgate him, push him off the road, whatever. And then when I get to 8 seconds, I go, God damn, look how big he is. I wish I hadn't done that. Oh, Jesus. Whoa, 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 would I like to go back and redo this little baby? Whoa, whoa. Or maybe you're feeling terrible, you got a little bit of a headache, and your 7-year-old son is on the way to school, and he stops into the kitchen, and you're sitting there, and you just, oh, geez, and he comes up and says, well, goodbye, Mom, I'm on my way to school. Stop bugging me! And as soon as the words are coming out of our mouth, we see the hurt look on his face, and we go, oh, God, I wish I hadn't said that. Only took 8 seconds to wish that you hadn't said it. Or maybe the boss comes in, and he said, you know that memo you wrote, Fred? It sucks. Screw you, I quit. And the words are going across the office, and you go, oh, God, give me those words back. He said, bye. So we got self-restraint. If I could just have this cushion, so we pray for that. So with self-restraint, there's all kinds of things that we don't have to fix. My friend Ed C. up in Washington, he has this great way of saying, he says, when I get ready to go out the door, I let five people be wrong ahead of time. You know what a cushion that is? I mean, people can just be all acting weirdo, in your face and everything. Well, that's one. Hey, hi, that's okay. And, you know, two, three. We're allowing the world to be as it is. Great way to not get disturbed. Things are not disturbing us because we have this self-restraint. However, it suggests we take spot check inventories as we're going through the day. Am I disturbed? What is causing this? Now we're going to go through the next three steps, which is an honest analysis of what's wrong. What is this? Well, that jerk over there, that woman, and she just started working. Here she came over and went, ba ba ba. So then we analyze it. And we go, well, is what she said inappropriate, or did you start it? Well, I hadn't said a word, and she came in. Well, maybe she had a rough weekend. Maybe she's really having a hard time. Maybe you could help her. Why don't you forgive her? Because if you do, you can get undisturbed. Would you rather be undisturbed or right? Ooh, that's a tough choice. Some people stay disturbed for the rest of their lives just to be right. I'm going to go get them, you know, and they die of ulcers and it's just all that. So forgiveness. And the last one is, if I decide that I triggered that, then I will make an amend immediately. When wrong, promptly admitted it. Just go over there and say, Mary, I'm very sorry. I snapped without even thinking. I wish you would forgive me and we could start the whole day over. Can I get you a cup of coffee? Wow. Oh, no. We wouldn't do that. Let's just sit and let it simmer all day, glare over there every 20 minutes or so. At lunch, we can talk about, man, it's really rough in there. You know, and just this thing grows into World War III. And we could have gone over there and said, you know, I snapped off. I'm really sorry. Here's, let me get you a cup of coffee. So the whole deal, it's just strange, isn't it? The whole deal, this whole package is so that I can have a day undisturbed. At the end of the day, it suggests that I might want to look back over the day and see where I may have been able to do better. Just look it over and say, you know, I did great all day in terms of not getting disturbed, being in harmony, except for that thing, and you know, I could have done it this way. This is how I could approach something like that, and we set ourselves up so that the next time that happens, we can behave in a different way. Now, what happens, you know, that's why, you know, at the beginning of the 24-hour day book, it says, look well to this day, the Sanskrit proverb, all the realities of life and the verities exist in this day. That's why, one day at a time. What is all that about? There's the past, there's the future, and there's today. Well, look at it one day. Pick a day next week, Thursday, and make it undisturbed day. Don't even try to get any work done. Don't have any other priorities except being undisturbed. You will be astounded at how much energy you conserve. You will probably get three times as much stuff done because it's exhausting to stay disturbed all day. Your creative juices are shut down. You can't problem solve worth a damn when you're dealing with a resentment and a pain in the pit of your stomach. And it's just astounding if we make this the priority. I want to stay in harmony. I want to stay undisturbed. And we are free to stay in contact with our higher power. We're free to be at the intuitive level where answers come much more freely. And we float through life in a much more efficient way. That's really what it talks about. We live more efficiently as a result of being undisturbed. So at the end of the day, we take this inventory, see how we can do this over, and we put together a day. Now, when we put together one day where we look at it and just go, what a day. I'm out with people I'm in harmony with. I enjoyed those people. It is really something. Now, the past has been haunting you. You've had this past with all these things that are worrying. In order to look at that past, you have to go through that day because that day is now part of the past. You just completed it. And so as you look back on the past, the headline to the past is not bad. And it changes how the whole past looks. And then when you look at the future, why does the future always be so frightening? Because we imagine an endless series of days like today when they're rotten. And we just go, God, I can't believe 20 more years of days like this. This is, oh, well, get one day well lived. And when we start looking to the future, we go, is the future going to consist of an endless series of days like this? I can hardly wait. So one day has the power to transform the past and the future right in our lives. And so that's why this step is such a blessing, and that we really do have the power within to change the world that we lived in. I always tell this little story with that, and then we'll move on. I imagine life, and I remember using the story in New Orleans in 1980. I imagine life like I was a pinball in a pinball machine. There's five of us sat down in the dark stools at the bar, you know what I mean, down below the pinball machine, hoping nobody would put a quarter, and the quarter was the alarm clock. And when they put it in, you know, you just went, oh, God, we're going out there, baby, we're going out there. I don't want to be going out there, you know, in the life. And then, bam, they hit that plunger, and you're up, you're ready. And they're pulling that thing back, oh, geez, I hope this is a good day. I hope this is a good day. And out you go. And over here, you're in the bumper, bam, 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 there's lights, there's this. You're over here, you're down here, and all you're looking for is that little hole. You get back in the bar at the end of the day. Man, give me a break out here. And you can see that hole, and you go, whoo, it's over. You're just dipping in, and some guy gets a flipper, and boom, you're all the way back up at the top. Bam, 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 bam. Jesus Christ, you know, you're coming down, you're just going in, and bam, he's there. You got the world champion pinball player out there. You're out there forever. You're exhausted when you get in. You just go, what a day I had. That was what I saw. I just said, that's the way I saw days. You're just out there, and the day just beats you around till it's through with you and drops you in the hole, and thank God you're in the bar. I need something to recover from that day. And now we have this other day, entirely different. It's a whole different world. The 11th step talks about prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact. Conscious contact is the point of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the whole point of being in AA, is to establish conscious contact, not knowledge about a personal higher power, but actual contact. You know, if we were drinking and somebody said to me, oh, I'm really into the drinking way of life. I got the drinking clothes. I wear a Budweiser shirt. I hang around the bar. I know the dart games. I know the pinball. I know the this. I know that. And you go, yeah, but do you drink? No, I don't really drink. Well, the whole point of this is to drink, man, so that you get contact with booze so it gets inside and things happen. I mean, all that stuff is just nothing. And all the rest of it is nothing if we don't get conscious contact. An inner awareness that there really is a power inside of us that loves us, that is willing to give us assurances on a daily basis that all is well, that will provide intuitive guidance so that decision making is made easier, so that our creativity is lifted to much higher levels. This is what conscious contact is for, and it's suggested it is achieved by prayer and meditation, which is how it's always been achieved throughout history. I don't know about you, but when I read the prayer of St. Francis, I'll tell you one thing. Maybe you're different than I am. I read the prayer of St. Francis. Make me channel thy peace. There was hatred, I can bring love. There was despair, I can bring hope. Fear, I can bring faith. I read that and I said, you know something? I never would have thought of that. That stuff doesn't come to me. I don't wake up going out, let me be a channel. I got other stuff, man. It's like, where's mine? I got to get, you know, I mean, it just, that's where I operate at. So this stuff is way up here compared to where I am. Well, that's where I want to be. So these are very mechanical ways to bring our minds into principles and concepts that don't come naturally. It doesn't come natural to think of bringing harmony and all these things and dying, which is the killing of the ego, so that we can have this conscious contact. It is suggested that meditation is one of the greatest ways to achieve conscious contact and peace of mind. You know, first time we try meditating, we can't sit still on the chair for 5 minutes. It's like, you got stuff to do. How long are we going to be in here? You know, what are you sitting on a chair for? Why are you standing in here? It's dark. It's quiet. Man, I'm getting nervous hanging around. I don't like sitting here. We got to get going, man. We got other things to do. What is it? 3 more minutes? Okay, 3 more minutes. I'll be out of here. Be out of here. Be out of here. Be out of here. It's like when they talk about peace of mind, I don't connect to that. What we need is peace from mind. That's what we need, is to get peace from mind. How the hell can we shut this stuff up in here? It's got something to say all the time. That's the discipline of meditation, is to show us, and it takes a lot of practice, but it is possible to quiet that so that there is an opportunity to go to a deeper level and have an awareness that there's something wonderful and we are part of it and this really makes sense and that this is not a rumor, that this really is true, everything that's happening in AA. And Bill suggests that our libraries are filled. Here's where we don't talk about conference-approved literature. We talk about, go to library, get any damn book you want on meditation. They're filled with them. Go to churches, go talk to people about it. It's an individual adventure, right out of the 12 and 12. Meditation is essentially an individual adventure. Your way of achieving this, of getting freedom from your own mind, is your way, and my way is my way. But when we get there, when we put in the efforts to do this, we will get the rewards of a sense of security, of inner awareness that things are well in spite of all the evidence to the contrary. And our final step, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. It wraps up the whole program. I mean, it's just saying, as a result of all these steps. So a spiritual awakening is a gift. We can't give it to ourselves. It's going to be given to us. But our job is to make ourselves prepared to receive it. I've always used the analogy of the country mailbox. The post office says, you live out in the country, you want to get mail, you build a mailbox with a post and you put it out here and it's this big and it has a door and the guy in the Jeep can pull up and put your mail in. So the alcoholic's going, hey man, I think it's going to take forever to build that thing. I don't have a saw. I don't have just throw my mail on the lawn. I'll get it out there. That'll be all right. So the post office is limited by its regulations. It doesn't throw the mail on the lawn. It just holds it. And he sits there going, nobody ever writes to me. Everybody else gets a letter. Everybody else gets magazines. Everybody else gets this stuff. I never get any of this stuff. So I've never had a spiritual awakening. But there were spiritual awakenings knocking on our door all the time, just like there were mail out there. And it was like we were saying, mail for Sandy Beach. And I'm going, he's not home. I'm turning away all the gifts from my higher power, and by not making myself prepared to receive them, I claim they don't exist. That's my proof that there's no higher power. None of those things ever happened to me. Well, did you make yourself ready to receive this? Have you built the mailbox? Have you, in fact, gone through these 12 steps and cleared all, as Prayer of St. Francis, make me a channel. So our mailbox is a channel. And once we open that up wide enough so that these things can flow in, we will get the gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous. I feel that, in closing, the gift of AA, if you're new, is you. You're the gift. You're the package. And the program is going to enable you to unwrap the package. So you've never unwrapped it. So you don't know what's in there, but you think there's something bad in there or whatever because you just know that. You know without opening it that you're no good or you're this or you're that. And then besides, the package is generally, when it arrives in AA, looks like it was wrapped with garbage paper. Doesn't look like much of a present to be worth opening. I mean, we arrive here, we're not very pretty pictures. And we're going, boy, we got this gift for you. Look in the mirror. There you are. And go, God, I don't want to open that. But these steps are going to show you that that's just some wrapping paper out there. That's got nothing to do with what we're going to find in there. We're going to strip away these instinctual drives, and we're going to strip away the past, and we're going to strip away a lot of ideas. All of the ideas that you brought here that are wrong. Charlie Bruton, a friend of mine, used to say, it isn't the things you don't know that kill you. It's knowing things for sure that just ain't so. And we know a lot of things for sure that ain't so. And this beautiful program of sobriety is, as Chuck Chamberlain says, uncover, discover, discover. What other thing do I have that's wrong that I can throw away? When you think about character building, you don't get anything. You get rid of things. We're getting rid of this, getting rid of that. It's like spirituality is a balloon ride. The more stuff you throw overboard, the higher you go. And the better the view. And that's what I think has to happen. The view has to get better every year, or we feel like the program isn't working. And it begins with that unwrapping, where you have a sponsor, you have a group, and you are fearlessly willing to go through this process of getting rid of the phony you, getting rid of all that stuff that is simply not true, and allowing the brilliance of your goodness. See, you really are a wonderfully good person. You really want to treat everybody great. You really want to love the people around you. You really want to be in harmony. You want to be a good mother. You want to be a good teacher. You want to be a good citizen. You want all these things. That's who you really are. We got to let you out. We got to get the garbage out of the way. And the 12th step is suggesting we, all our affairs, we bring these principles so that we can be go from AA out into the other world. This isn't a place to hide. This is a place to open the door into the world so that we can go out and be as comfortable with non-AA people as we are with AA people. And walk out there and say, there's a lovely person just like my friend in AA. There's another lovely person. There's another lovely person just like my friends in AA. And the people respond that way. And pretty soon you see yourself in their eyes and you recognize you are a person of value, that there is tremendous value inside of you. You have tremendous contributions to make to society. You have wonderful gifts that have been given to you by God. And now you have a new perspective on all of that. Instead of using those God-given talents to selfishly benefit ourselves, and then everybody doesn't want to be around us, we find out how these talents can be used to be useful in our daily lives, useful to others, to be of service to others. People are attracted to us as never before. We succeed beyond our wildest dreams, and we didn't try for any of it. We simply surrendered into this program, into the spiritual process, and learned that God had in store for us things we never dreamed of. Thank you all very much, and God bless.
Thank you.